Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Hi, good morning and welcome. This is Rabbi Michael Katz here, Judaism 101.9, as we have taken on our new slot and beautifully coming through to you, hopefully today, loud and clear. I think there were some transmitter issues over the last couple of days, but thank God it seems to be restored. And here we are, loud and clear. Judaism 101.9 coming to you live from the studios of Chai FM here in Johannesburg. And yes, as we always begin on Judaism 101.9, we look back a little bit in history to see if we can pick up a developing theme. And today, I think for this coming week, there is an incredible theme that we actually pick up. You know, we're living at a time where, for the first time in a long, long time, we've kind of been subject to anti-Semitism all over the world. It's spread like wildfire through all parts of the world, it seems, after October the 7th, after the terrible massacre, after all of those things that happened over the last couple of years, and of course, the inability for people to see that this has nothing to do with Jews and Judaism, but it has everything to do with all sorts of jealousies and all sorts of other problems and issues, and of course a latent anti-Semitism that keeps on rearing its ugly head is absolutely nothing new. Now, we've been through this before. What do they say? You know, this is not our first rodeo. This is not the first time the Jews have suffered anti-Semitism. And if we think about a developing theme that I'd like to point out to you in history, in this week, the 18th of Shvat, and we go back to 1639. Now, that's a while back. In 1639, on this day, on the 18th of Shvat, there was something called an auto de fe, which was held in Lima, Peru. Think about it. Lima, Peru, South America, auto de fe. What's an auto de fe? An auto de fe was when Jews would not convert to Catholicism, the church had a burning at the stake ceremony, which was meted out to these Jews. And so we have an Inquisition that happened sometime before that in Europe. It arrived on American shores. And 12 Jews were burnt in an auto de fe in Lima, Peru, on the 18th of Shvat in 1639. 63 Jews had been condemned at the time to various punishments. 11 were burnt alive at the stake, along with the body of a 12th, who had committed suicide during the trial. So think about the gruesome brutality. Think about what happened on that day, 18th of Shvat. But embedded in the day, of course, is 18, Chai. So Chai Shvat, 1639, this terrible, terrible event takes place. And amongst those who were burnt at the stake was a man called Manuel Bautista Perez. And he was reported to have been the richest man in Peru at the time. Richest man in Peru. Burnt at the stake. You start thinking there must have been something else going on here. As well as Francisco Maldonado de Silva, a surgeon, a poet, and a philosopher, who was seized in Chile in 1627. He remained in the dungeons of the Inquisition, it says, for nearly 12 years. His devotion to his faith never wavered, though, and while in prison, he is said to have converted two Catholics to Judaism. Auto de fe, 1639, this time, anti-Semitism coming from a very, very different source, but still terrible and awful, and the brutality and the cruelty that was meted out to Jews. But let's go back to 1349. So we're going a few hundred years earlier on the 19th of Shvat, on which is going to be, of course, on Friday. What happened here was the Black Death raged through Switzerland, and poison was reported to have been found in the wells at Zofingen in Switzerland. Some Jews were put to the thumbscrews test, whereupon they admitted their guilt of the charges brought against them. This discovery was then communicated to the people of Basel in Zurich and in Freiburg and even in Cologne, and the Jews of Basel were burnt on an island in the Rhine on the 9th of January, which was the 19th of Shvat in 1349 in wooden huts that were especially built for the occasion. Their children, who were spared, were taken and forcibly baptized. So, Black Death linked to and blamed on certain obvious blood libels and tragic blaming of Jews for the ills, for the pandemics of that time. And this is in 1349, where they built on an island huts in which they burned Jews to death. It happens to be a similar theme if we go way forward to 2002. Now, this is something that most of us would remember. There was a man called Daniel Pearl. And Daniel Pearl was an American-born Jewish reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He was kidnapped by terrorists in Karachi, by a militant group that called itself the National Movement for the Restoration of Pakistani Sovereignty, who claimed that Pearl was a spy. And 9 days later, on the 19th of Shvat, in an awful, awful event that was videotaped, Pearl was beheaded. And the gruesome tape has Pearl stating, incredibly, "My father's Jewish, my mother's Jewish, I'm Jewish." It's a fascinating testament to the kind of character and the kind of depth of Mesiras Nefesh that is in the heart and soul of each and every Jew, no matter what the world threw at us, whether it was the auto da fe in Peru, whether it was the Jews of Basel who were burned alive in 1349, or whether it was Daniel Pearl murdered brutally for being Jewish in 2002. Same story, anti-Semitism, same idea, get rid of the Jews at all costs. But then as we move later into the week, and here is the positive energy of the latter part of the week, on the 20th of Shvat, which is on Shabbos, Osher, the son of Jacob, was born. He was born on the 20th of Shvat in the year 2199 from creation, or 1562, before the Common Era. And according to some accounts, this is also the date of his passing. We have said that on this show quite often. Many righteous people passed away on their birthdays. Quite an incredible thing. And of course, we're going only by Jewish dates. Now, flip it to the 21st of Shvat, which is going to be on Sunday. In 1657, on the 21st of Shvat, which was the 4th of February, Oliver Cromwell, the Lord Protector of England, issued the first residence permit to a Jew. His name, Louis Carvajal, and since the expulsion of all Jews from England by King Edward I in 1290. So think about that, 1290 to 1657. Oliver Cromwell gave permission for the first Jew to get a residence permit. And during that period of time, of those 400 odd years, the edict of expulsion had officially been overturned in the previous year, in 1656. The readmittance of Jews into England was partially due to the efforts of the great scholar, Rabbi Menashe ben Yisroel. Isn't that amazing that these kind of edicts in places like England, where we thought things were and could be great, but embedded in its past, are these terrible, terrible expulsions. Jews not allowed to live there, not allowed to possess property, not allowed to have residence permits. And did you know that Oliver Cromwell was the first one to give a Jew permission to come back into England all those years ago? The 22nd of Shvat is a date of note. It has, and it marks, the yahrzeit of the Kotzke Rebbe in 1859, Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotzk, renowned Hasidic leader, forerunner of the Ger Hasidic dynasty, and others, is commemorated on this day. And we have often spoken about on Judaism 101.9, the day of passing of a tzaddik, of a righteous person, not only elevates their soul, but elevates all the souls and people who come into contact with their works and the things that they stood for. The Kotzke Rebbe, so widely quoted. And it also is the yahrzeit of our Rebbetzin, the Rebbetzin Chaya Mushka Schneerson, who was born in 1901. She was the wife of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. She passed away on the 22nd of Shvat, Chof Bei Shvat, in the year 5748, which was 1988. The Rebbetzin, an incredibly notable Tzedakah, a righteous woman, who was mourned by her husband in the most incredible fashion. We'll talk a little bit more about that after the break, but an incredibly powerful date on Chof Bei Shvat, the 22nd day of Shvat, which comes up, of course, next week, Tuesday.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Hi and welcome back. This is Rabbi Michael Katz. This is Judaism 101.9. And I thought today we would take a look at some Judaism 101.9 points to do with eating. Yeah, we have a tremendous amount of time that we spend during our days eating. You know, one of the hidden reasons, I suppose, behind fast days is that you suddenly have so much more time on your hands. It's not just that time seems to go slower when you are hungry, but it is that you do have more time. Think about the amount of time that we spend focused on meals, eating, cooking, preparation, etc., and then probably the recovery afterwards. It's a big chunk of our days and nights, I guess, eating. But there are so many laws, rules, regulations, ideas from a Jewish perspective that pertain to eating, and I'd like to begin with thinking a little bit about bread. Bread itself has so many unique attributes and so many unique usages in Judaism that it's absolutely incredible. And we think about the fact that from a Jewish point of view, bread has a certain sanctity to it, and we show it a kind of respect. Well, let's delve into it a little bit and think about, you know, we all know that on Shabbat, on Shabbos, we have unique Shabbos loaves. We know that there is a certain place of honor that bread has as the foundation of any meal. And on Shabbat and holidays, on Shabbos and Yom Tov, after we say Kiddush over wine, the first food we eat is bread. But there is a custom that while we make Kiddush, since we are highlighting the Kiddush itself and the wine or the grape juice over which we're making that Kiddush, we cover the bread. And yeah, one of the major reasons why we cover the bread is so as not to disgrace it in any way, not to embarrass the bread, so to speak. Something else is being lauded and praised in front of it. And so when we make Kiddush, we cover the bread. That's where the idea of a challah, cover, comes from. Of course, it's also the idea that the bread that fell, the manna that fell in the desert, was on a cloth. It was on a layer of dew, so it didn't become all sandy, and it was covered to protect it from the sun, that it shouldn't disintegrate, melt away, or become burnt by the rays of the sun. And therefore, we mimic that as well on our Shabbos table, a board or a tablecloth underneath, a cover over it. So all showing tremendous respect, kavod, honor for the bread. Many people have braided soft challah loaves for Shabbos, but Jewish communities around the world have all sorts of different traditions. For example, Yemenite Jews traditionally serve lachuch, a delicious flat fried bread, while on Persian tables you might find barbari, a flat glazed bread that's equally special. Now, bread is treated with respect, and we have already mentioned one of those respects, but, you know, we shouldn't throw bread or do anything that might spoil it. And the examples that Shulchan Aruch gives is we don't pass a liquid over it or place raw meat on top of it, which would make it inedible. We wouldn't just waste bread. And we avoid throwing away edible pieces of bread that are olive-sized or larger. Any piece of bread, don't throw it away. You may want to, after Shabbos or Yom Tov, you may want to feed it to the birds. You may want to give it to your pets. You may want to use it in some other concoction that you're making. But it shouldn't be thrown away. It's not just discarded. We also have special care that we take. Even when we dispose of crumbs, it's customary not to toss breadcrumbs onto the ground where people may step on them. Disrespect for the crumbs or the bread. According to tradition, throwing breadcrumbs and stepping on them could invite, God forbid, poverty in your home. Well, if that's one thing that people out there are going to think about, again, as soon as you say, well, sure, this could bring poverty, and not in a superstitious way, but it's showing a disregard for bread, for food that Hashem gave us. You know, when we travel overseas, I guess you do too, we see in certain countries there's a tremendous amount of food wastage. Now, I think that Jews probably were ingrained, and it perhaps flips or works both ways. People were ingrained in their minds the value of food. We don't throw away a morsel of food because we had so many times when we didn't have enough food to eat, starved in the concentration camps or starved by poverty in Eastern Europe and so on. And so the idea of the value of every morsel of food was significant, and how much more so when it came to bread, which is the staple and represented all that we have spoken about, representing a meal. But it probably played the other way as well, that there are those who, you know, will always want to leave over of their food. And it is a tradition, yes, that we don't eat every morsel of bread on the table, kind of licking the platter clean when it comes to bread. But the idea of abundance is that we consider our Shabbos table and we have more than we need. But yes, what happens to that food afterwards? The idea of wasting good food is something that kind of turns the stomach of any individual, and it's a very harsh thing to see that at the end of perhaps you've attended a wedding overseas or elsewhere where whole plates of food are just thrown in the garbage. And why? Because there are all sorts of rules about recycling it and so on. And of course, there are great organizations in South Africa and around the world that take that food and give it to the poor, and it just sits so much better. But when it comes to bread, even the crumbs, we are careful with how we dispose of them. We know that we dip our bread into salt, or we sprinkle salt on it, depending on the customs differences, but the idea of salt. Why salt on bread? The idea is here that it mimics a korban, a sacrifice. The sacrifices had salt on them. Why salt? Salt is something that is enduring. Salt never spoils. Salt never goes off. It's got a lifetime guarantee when it comes to salt, and therefore the idea of making it eternal. But it also has a unique property. Salt itself doesn't taste good by itself, but it enhances the flavor of everything else. And this is the idea of enhancing. We're known that the people of Sodom and Gomorrah were punished for not offering their guests salt. Salt, and that's why perhaps the place was punished with becoming pillars of salt, a sea of salt, etc., and the whole area very salty, because the fact that they never wanted their guests to feel comfortable. Give them raw bread, but don't give them anything with it. Don't make it taste good. Don't allow it, or don't encourage that the person might come back and ask for more. Just if you're giving something, give the minimum. And the salt represents maximizing. It represents bringing out the best in that food, and therefore something very special. Yeah, when you think about bread and its significance, when we come to our high festivals, when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, there's a custom that we dip the bread in honey, perhaps in addition to salt. Some do in addition, some instead of the salt. And this is the idea of bringing sweetness into everything. So the bread there represents our main idea of our meal, and the salt or the honey. By the way, honey is also something, I don't know if you know, but honey is also something that never goes off. So it's got the same eternal quality. It's got the same idea of being everlasting, of making it something that will be there for always. But it has the idea of sweetness when it comes to the high festivals, when we're talking about Shana Tova Umetuka. Now, there is one fascinating point that we have, that many people, especially on a Shabbat when we make hamotzi, that we grasp the bread with 10 fingers. So we wash our hands, recite a bracha, on the bread, and we say the blessing. Some people have the custom to hold the bread with all 10 fingers. So you may have seen that some people actually pick up the chalot and some people put their hands on it. Why? 10 fingers represent, we're told, 10 mitzvahs that are connected with bread and its preparation. And this is quoted in the Shulchan Aruch HaRav, in the Alter Rebbe Shulchan Aruch and Orach Chaim 1677, where it talks about these different mitzvahs of preparation of bread. So let's go through them. Number one is the prohibition to plow with a cow and a donkey together, the prohibition to sow mixed seeds, leaving, so this of course is everything before the bread becomes bread. We leave fallen stalks for the poor. We leave forgotten sheaves for the poor. We set aside a corner of the field for the poor. We bring the first kernels to the temple. We separate truma for the Kohen. We separate a tithe for the Levites. We separate a second tithe to eat in Jerusalem. And that all leads to the separation of challah, 10 different mitzvahs that we actually build up and think about at the time of the separation of challah and the baking of bread. Quite incredible, and the idea of our 10 fingers. It's not, as we used to say at school, place your 10 fingers on the holy Jewish Torah and make an oath. We don't make any oaths. It doesn't matter, the 10 fingers on the holy Jewish Torah. But what it does talk about is the 10 fingers on the challah represents the 10 mitzvahs leading up to the making of bread. We always leave over some uneaten bread. We said that before. We don't polish off the loaf of bread. This symbolizes blessing and abundance, according to Shulchan Aruch, and it is something that we should do. And then, of course, those extra pieces are not just discarded. We don't throw away bread straight directly into the rubbish, into the garbage. Rather, put it out, give it to an animal, give it to or use it in a preparation of another meal, perhaps. You know, one of the incredible things, and this is not the recipe show, and the ladies who do that, of course, are going to be a little upset with me if I give you a recipe. Here's a recipe for what to do with leftover challah. You know, if you toast it and you then put it into your mix master. You mix it up, you chop it up, put it into your blender. Ah, that's the word I was looking for. You put it into your blender. You have your own homemade breadcrumbs, and they keep pretty well if you put them in a Ziploc bag in the freezer and take them out when you need them. Well, there's an idea of how to reinvent or reuse or show some more respect to bread, reuse it as breadcrumbs. There's a custom of not passing bread directly to people. Now, you know, at a Shabbat table, you will have seen that people pass the bread in different ways. So let's go first things first. When you cut the challah on Friday night, there are some people who break, there are some people who cut. I'm not going to say which one is which and which you need to do or if there is a must do, but there was always a tradition to make a cut and perhaps then to break the bread. Of course, it tastes a little bit better when it's broken rather than sliced, I guess. Don't know why that is, but it just is. And then you distribute the challah. Now, the person has to understand that once you've made a bracha on the challah, you need to eat that piece. You need to eat a piece of bread straight away. Otherwise, there's a break between your making of the bracha and so on. So we don't act gentlemanly and distribute bread to everybody first and then eat. No, you should make the bracha, you eat, and then distribute. And the distribution is done in a couple of different ways. There are some who say we shouldn't throw bread. However, it is certainly a custom in many places, many Sephardi communities as well, and therefore we cannot say that there's anything wrong with it, where the challah is actually thrown. And it's also this idea, I guess, of abundance. We are passing it around. But possibly all comes, or the main Ashkenazi way, of course, is to either cut or break up the bread, put it in a basket, pass it around, put it on the table for everybody to help themselves. Now, the idea of not passing it directly, we are told, in Shulchan Aruch comes from when we serve mourners, the bread, you know, everybody knows about the round, the bagel, that is handed to them directly. They are served. It's given to them directly. It's for this reason that it's customary not to hand bread directly to anyone else to avoid any association, God forbid, with mourning. There we're like feeding them. Here we don't. We don't pass them the bread directly. Instead, it's placed on the table, or as we said, on a board or on a, in a basket, and left for others to take for themselves. We do not give the bracha bread to an animal. Piece of bread when you start the meal is a special status because a blessing was made over it. So this bread that you made the bracha over for the first piece that you took a bite out of, we don't share that with an animal. It is customary not to feed that particular piece to an animal because it is a bracha bread. We've elevated it to a completely different status. We've made it even holier than regular bread or breadcrumbs or offcuts that we may give to the birds, to animals, etc.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Hi and welcome back. As we said, Judaism 101.9 today, exploring some things of Judaism 101.9 and looking at historical facts and thinking about the fact that we are coming up for a significant date of the 22nd of Shvat, which is the yahrzeit of the Rebbetzin Chaya Mushke Schneerson, who was the wife of the Lubavitcher Rebbe for many, many years, and of course was this most incredible image or personality after whom so many Jewish women around the world would like to look up to, model themselves, and should be doing so because she was absolutely incredible in every possible way. First of all, a woman who married to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who herself had no children, but became the mother of all the Hasidim, really, of the Rebbe. So literally thousands and thousands of children around the world, and especially today, many more than that. And there are so many who, since her passing in 1988, have named their daughters Chaya Mushke after her. So whenever you come across today a young lady by the name of Chaya Mushke, you'll know that she's named for the Rebbetzin Chaya Mushke Schneerson. Now, this was a lady who did not at all, ever, have anything to do with the limelight. This was not a woman who went out there and grabbed any of the limelight in any possible way. In fact, the complete opposite, completely humble, completely out of the limelight. And in fact, I can tell you, as an individual who lived in New York for several years, in Crown Heights, in Brooklyn, in the same neighborhood, I think I saw the Rebbetzin once, maybe twice, in all the time that I was there. But that didn't mean that she didn't play a role. On the contrary, the Rebbetzin was a woman who, in the early days, drove her own car. She was someone who was out there. She was a librarian in a public library, and the most incredible partner for the Rebbe, enabling him to do all the most incredible work that he did, of course, over his decades of being Rebbe and leading the worldwide Chabad Lubavitch movement, and seeing to it that Judaism was strengthened, bolstered, established with schools, yeshivas, mikvahs, Chabad houses, institutions around the world. She was really, in inverted commas, if I may say, the power behind the throne of the Rebbe, and the Rebbe himself referred to her in that way. When she passed in 1988, the Rebbe mourned for her. As we said, they had no children. The Rebbe said Kaddish for her for the entire year, not only doing that, but also davening from the Omid, in other words, leading the davening services throughout the year. And the Rebbe prayed in his home. They wanted to daven, and they set up a little shul, so to speak, in the front room of the Rebbe's house. People would go there to make a minyan on a daily basis, because that was where her energy was, that was where she was, that was where she lived, that was her place, that was her space, her place of reference. And the Rebbe brought all the prayers and all the things that he spoke about during that year, all had to do with her and her incredible influence and stateliness and tznius, her modesty, and everything that she stood for in the most powerful and incredible fashion. So it is in this week that we really salute not only the Rebbetzin and everything that she stood for, but the profound and important role of Jewish women. Judaism often gets a bad rap for being male-oriented and male-dominant. And in fact, if we think about it deeply, the only reason why males need time-bound mitzvot is because otherwise we're afraid that they won't be thinking of God, they won't be doing all of those things. The women whose neshamas, whose souls, are connected in a higher frame, in a higher way, in a more mystical and spiritual fashion, have that naturally. And the role of the Jewish women in Jewish life is not only as important as men, but more important than the role of the men. It is the women after whom the children get their Jewishness, after all. It is the women, the mother, that children learn from, not only how to speak and what to say, but the accent, the tone. And yes, we're talking about bread and food and so on, but the kashrus of the home and the chinuch, the education of the children, everything rests so squarely on the shoulders of the mother, of the woman role within Judaism, that it is indeed the women who ensure that not only is there a Jewish today, but there will be a flourishing and beautiful Jewish tomorrow. Be back with you right after this.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Hi and welcome back. Yes, Judaism 101.9. This is Rabbi Michael Katz, and yes, we are speaking about things to do with the period of time that we're in. We're speaking about Chof Beis Shvat, the coming date of the passing of the Rebbetzin. Now, when we think about the passing of an individual, when a person passes, there is a strong connection with that soul, with that individual during the first year. If we think about it, it is the Shiva period that is followed by the Shloshim, that is followed by the 11 months of Kaddish, that is followed by the 12 months of mourning. And we then reach the first Yahrzeit, and we believe there is an elevation of the soul, and the soul ascends higher and higher with each Yahrzeit, with each day of commemoration of their passing. The Rebbe often explained that when it comes to the date of the passing of a tzaddik, of a righteous person, that tzaddik is perhaps even in the world, connected to the world through what they stood for and what they wrote and what they taught, and through their righteousness, they're connected with us in an even stronger way, instead of it being more distant as the years pass, but it's even more powerful and stronger with the passing years. And each day is a day on which we can and we do think about the tzaddik, the righteous person, through their writings, through the things they taught. We live by what they said and what they did, and imitating or following or copying their ways, and not the least of which is, of course, our Rebbetzin, that it's not only on the Yahrzeit that we think about her and that we think about all that she taught us, but she is alive and dominant in our every day and in our behaviors, as she should be, in an even stronger way on a daily basis, regularly, not just on the day of her Yahrzeit. So while Chof Beis Shvat, while the 22nd of Shvat marks the Yahrzeit, as the Rebbe liked to call it, as people often do, a Hilula, Hilula being a day of elevation of the soul rather than a Yahrzeit. Yahrzeit simply is the statement of it being a year's time. It's a 1 year that's passed, and we sort of check it off on the calendar, and we say, okay, so now it was so many years and so many days, and another day is ticked off. It's not that at all. It's rather how she is elevated and how she helps to elevate us on a regular basis, on a daily basis, and that each day should be filled with the kind of things that the great tzaddikim, the righteous who have passed on, that they taught us. Every day we live with Moshe Rabbeinu. Every day we think about Sarah, Rivka, Rachel and Leah and Avram, Yitzchak and Yaakov. And every day we think about those of our tzaddikim, of our righteous, who have given us so much, taught us so much, and continue to help to elevate us as we think about the elevation of their souls on high. So that's Chopei Shvat coming up next week, the 22nd of Shvat. So I want to wish you a great rest of the week, a great Shabbat up ahead, a great commemoration of Chopei Shvat, or the 22nd of Shvat, early next week. I look forward to being back with you same time, same place next week at 11 a.m. on a Thursday, on Thursdays going forward, for your slot of Judaism 101.9.